I started off by joining a group called New Right. That was a science writing group that brought together scientists, writers, people in theatre, meet people from the media to collaborate. My goal was just to write better science papers so that I could get published in my like niche journals, but like fancier niche journals that would get me like tenure and promotion and funding. But I was around these people and I liked these people and I was drawn to them and I found myself learning a lot from them in a way that I didn't learn from my colleagues who were in the same niches as me, doing the same things, thinking very deeply about MRI and whether this analysis technique works. And they were wonderful too, but this was a different kind of wonderful.
Connecting the dots with the Renaissance people.
Hello, Renaissance people and people who would like to cultivate a Renaissance mindset. I'm Renaissance woman Sarah Kobilka. I help my fellow Renaissance people confidently live expansive lives. Today's guest has joined me in embracing the title of Renaissance woman, and you'll see what it took to get her to embrace that title soon. Welcome to episode 12, A Different Kind of Wonderful with Paula Croxon. The alternative name that I came up for with this episode is How Paula Came to Love Swimming in Chop, and that too will soon make sense, but a little bit later. Now, a little bit about Paula. She has been near the top of my dream guest list since I came up with the idea for this podcast. So to say that I'm excited, it's a little bit of an understatement. And yes, regular listeners are not going to be surprised by this. Our Venn diagrams are highly overlapping. She's an absolutely intriguing woman, and I can't wait for you to get to know her. In today's episode, you're going to learn about Paula's science versus musician choice, aka the air quotes right brain versus left brain choice that I myself felt like I had to go through back in high school. We're going to actually dig into that, the history and the misconceptions of left brain versus right brain. We're going to talk about the Renaissance man, neuroscientist, and all-around inspirational figure, Oliver Sacks. We'll talk about how the athletic mindset plus Renaissance people equals flow state, and how there is actually research on flow state. It's not just a woo-woo type of thing. We'll discuss what MRIs can tell us and what they can't tell us, why the science is in the nuance and complicating the narrative. We'll discuss Paula's major career pivot, and we'll talk about how Communications 101, Know Thy Audience, as well as your own values, is key to explaining yourself and finding your golden thread. Finally, we talk a little bit about training our pets to do unusual things, and I do want to give the warning that pet loss is discussed at the very end of this episode, as it was the very first one I recorded after losing my wonderful dog, Choya. If you're interested in learning from and getting inspired by other Renaissance people and joining our community, visit www.renwomanconsulting.com. That's Ren with one N, to sign up for my Renaissance People newsletter. In it, you'll get updates about the podcast, including having the extensive show notes neatly packaged and placed directly into your inbox for any rabbit hole diving that we may inspire. And if you enjoy this episode, there's a link to buy me an oat milk cappuccino, the caffeinated beverage that gets me through the day, and it helps me defray the costs associated with creating this show, which I adore. So without further ado, here we go. Hello, Paula. I am so happy to have you joining me today. And I'm very excited to ask you the first question that I ask all of my guests. I'm intrigued to see where your answer comes down. So I sent you this ahead of time so that you have a little time to process and think about it. Which of these terms aligns best with your identity? Are you a Renaissance person, a multi-passionate generalist, versatilist, Jack Jill, Jay of all trades, boundary space? Banner, or is there something else out there that really encapsulates you in your complexity?
Hey, Sarah, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm laughing because my cat just tried to take all my equipment off the desk.
Of course. They're so good that way.
So yeah, I decided that I was going to poll some of my science communication friends to help me answer this question.
That's wonderful.
I couldn't decide. I think some of these terms are overlapping, but also I felt drawn to a couple of them. But they said without hesitation that I'm a Renaissance person.
I love that.
I identify as a woman, so Renaissance woman or Renaissance person. They were absolutely certain of it. And so I felt like maybe, and this happened to me when I changed career as well, which maybe we'll get into. I feel like other people sometimes see me more clearly than I see myself.
Well, I am in full agreement with all of your science communication friends, some of whom I might already know, since we are both operating in overlapping Venn diagrams significantly. When I first came up with the idea of the show, I created an Excel document where I was listing people who I wanted to have on as guests. And you were like first or second person I thought of, honestly, of who I wanted to have on. I think you and I actually haven't spent a ton of time together in person, though we have actually gotten to be in person because we're both in New York. But I have followed you on social media, and we'll talk later on about how other people can join in that fun. But just seeing what you were posting about and knowing about your many different interests, I just absolutely saw like a kindred spirit, a fellow Renaissance woman or Renaissance person. So I back what everyone else said and agree. That is the term that jumped to mind for me immediately. Was that one of your top terms?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a term that I was really familiar with until you started using it about yourself. And then I was like, oh, that's a really interesting term. And I looked it up and it resonated with me then. I think I've heard a lot of the other terms used in spaces where I've shown up. So I think some of those other terms could apply to me. I definitely have described myself in a slightly less jargony way as a Jack or Jill of all trades.
Sure.
I've hung out in some spaces where the phrase boundary spanner is very helpful to talk about kind of bringing people together. But I think of boundary spanner maybe as a really useful professional term, but I feel like a Renaissance person all the time, regardless of whether I'm behaving like a professional or not.
Yeah. As I've been interviewing people for the podcast, I have kind of had to take that perspective of there is kind of your career and what category do you fall in for your career versus just you as a person, which encapsulates both your career and your extracurriculars or hobbies or interests or mindset. So I've seen that in other people too, of when they're thinking about themselves, looking at it in those different ways. Well, that is wonderful. Well, Paula, thank you so much for joining me on the show. And I am excited to dig into all of these things that make you such an interesting person to follow on social media and to know about. As I've said with multiple other guests, you and I have Venn diagrams that look very, very similar. Even the fact that we are both flautists is one of our overlapping Venn diagram categories.
What a cool one.
And fun fact, the very first CD that I ever owned, so I'm going to age myself for some younger listeners, my first CD was jazz flute. That was the very first CD I ever got from my parents as a present.
My goodness. The very first concert I remember going to that wasn't classical music was a Jethro Tull. So there you go.
There you go. There we go. Well, let's talk about these areas of expertise along with playing flute and being a musician and being, you've already talked about being a scientist and a science communicator. What are some of your areas of expertise where people, when they're thinking of somebody, they're like, Paula, that's who I want to have involved with this project, or that's who I want to ask advice from, or something like that.
Yeah. So I don't think of flautist or musician being at the forefront of my professional capabilities, again, when people are thinking of that. But I am somebody that people think of when they think of a musician. And I think that's very cool because I feel like science and music was one of those choices that I had to make pretty early on, that I've spoken to so many people who ended up in science or as musicians who felt like they had to make that choice early on in order to define themselves, to carve out what they were doing. When I say had to, I don't think anyone made me. I had a lot of really supportive people around me when I was figuring out what I wanted to be when I grew up, but I felt like it only made sense to be one or the other. And I actually stopped playing music for a really long time while I was in graduate school. And so I sometimes forget that I'm a musician. Because I spent so much time creating this version of myself that was the scientist. So yeah, the number one thing, when I list out the things that I am, I say I'm a neuroscientist, I'm a science communicator, and I'm a storyteller. And then as a kind of an afterthought, I say that I'm a flautist and an open water swimmer. So those are like my five terms that I come back to the most.
That is spectacular. And again, I see so much of these same themes, like you said with a lot of people, I have so many friends who are scientists but had been very involved with music. I played flute. I was in all-state band. I played it for the first 2 years when I was in college. And I also felt that same sort of no one directly telling me that I had to pick, but this overall message from society. And the way that I like to describe it is that it was like, are you a left brain person or are you a right brain person? And the interesting thing for me was that I got done with school and I had excelled in all the left brain stuff and the right brain stuff, which, you know, we know is a very false dichotomy. I'll put a link.
Why I'm laughing.
Yeah. I'll put a link in the show notes. Everybody take a drink, okay? That's the theme. Anytime I say link in the show notes, we're both lifting our glass. Oh, well, if I took the lid off of my water bottle, it'd be certainly easier to take a drink. Refreshing. Take a drink every time we put something in the show notes, and by the end of this episode, you will be thoroughly hydrated or in some other state of being. But when I had to pick that left brain or right brain thing at the end of high school, I think it was because you had to like declare a major or decide school you wanted to go to. So you had to find one that was good at that thing you wanted to do if you even knew it. And for me, I had decided, well, you know, I like being on the stage. I certainly like the sound of applause, but I'm not going to go into theater. I don't think I could hack it. So I had gotten started being involved with TV when I was part of the youth and government program in Minnesota and had had the chance to be on camera and done the editing side of it. And I really enjoyed all that aspect of TV. And then I did a mentorship at WCCO, which is the CBS affiliate in Minneapolis. And for my last semester of high school, I would skip out of school for like the last half of the day, at least a couple of days per week, and then shadow different people in different departments at the TV station. I was like, oh, I guess I'm just going to say goodbye to math and science forever. You know, I took my AP Calc test and I scored high enough that I got college credit for it. And then I just needed one lab-based science to graduate. And so I was like, okay, well, I guess we had a good run of it, math and science. You were fun, but moving on to picking my single career, what are you going to be singular when you grow up, which Michelle Obama also strongly disagrees with the idea of singular, but show notes, take a look. But I got there and I did one semester of the preparatory classes for my journalism degree, which didn't involve any math or science. And I got done and I was like, something's missing in my life, in my world. I don't feel like me. I don't feel like a whole Sarah. And that's when I decided, well, you know, if I want to be in TV and I want to increase the number of jobs I can apply for, there is this role of meteorologist on TV. And they have to do math and science. And the people sometimes have a job where they'll be a reporter and they'll be a meteorologist. So I decided I'm going to bring math and science back into my life. And quite a few people in the journalism program looked at me like I was absolutely nuts because I took chemistry, I took physics, I was taking calculus. And they're all like, why? What's wrong with you? What are you doing? And I was like, no, I need this. Like, this is part of me too. I can't lose that. I need to use my full brain and not, quote, half of my brain, as the people like to talk about it. But from like a neuroscientist perspective, have you ever heard that messaging of like left brain, right brain, and had major problems with it the way I have?
Yes, yes, totally. And that's why I laughed when he said left brain, right brain, because to me, it's like one of those great misconceptions about the brain that it actually has a really interesting story, how left brain, right brain came into being.
Oh, did it?
Which is kind of cool. So just for those who don't have time to read the show notes, we use all of our brain all of the time, pretty much. It's actually remarkable. If you give somebody an MRI scan while they're engaged in something like having this kind of conversation or at rest, it would be imperceptible to the eye, the difference between those two states. Our brains are constantly working. Even when we're resting or sleeping, they're constantly on the go, and both hemispheres are on the go for most things all of the time. But there is a little thing called hemispheric specialization, which is where one hemisphere of the brain has a specialty in a particular area. And those are very few and far between. There aren't very many of them. And one of those is language. So most humans, I think around 98% of us maybe, have language faculty is localized to the left hemisphere of our brains. And a very small percentage of us, maybe it's more like 5%, I forget, many of whom are left-handed also. Oh. have language faculties on the right-hand side of their brains. And so number one, it's very biased against left-handed people to say left brain, right brain for thinking even about language. And so what happened is there were a series of studies decades ago now, which allowed us to look at this hemispheric difference. And I saw a talk by one of these scientists. Her name is Brenda Milner. She's a really fantastic neuroscientist. And she had an opportunity to study these people who had this surgery to divide the connections between the two hemispheres of the brain because they had epilepsy that wasn't treatable by drugs. And so in an effort to stop the seizures from spreading from one side of the brain to the other, they had this pretty extreme surgery. And in many ways, they were totally normal after the surgery, which is amazing, and it helped their epilepsy. But it left them with some weird phenomena, like they would find themselves getting dressed in the morning with one hand and the other hand changing the outfit. And they found that there were some things that we do need to coordinate across our hemispheres for. And they were able to bring those people into the lab and do things like have them look straight ahead and show things in their left visual field, which would only go to the right side of their brain, or to the right visual field, which would only go to the left side of the brain. When they showed things to the left side of the brain, like an object, so let's say they showed a spoon, then they'd say, what do you see? And the person would say, oh, I see a spoon. If they showed the object to the right side of the brain, the person would not be able to respond, because their right side of the brain, it knew what it was seeing, but it had no way to express what it was seeing. And so people would not say anything at all, but more frequently, their left hemisphere would get in there and start confabulating. So let's say that the right hemisphere saw a spoon and they asked the person to pick it up. They could do that, right? The right hemisphere could control movement. Then they would say, why did you pick up the spoon? The left hemisphere would intervene. Brenda Milner calls it the chatty left hemisphere. It would intervene. And it would say, oh, well, I was just feeling a bit hungry, so I figured I'd pick up a spoon so I would have it for after this so I could eat my lunch. And that's how the left brain got a reputation for being the logical, I'm using air quotes here, the logical side of the brain, because it rationalized, because it got in there and it was chatty and it explained away the movements of the right hemisphere, having no idea that the whole reason was because the right hemisphere of the brain had just seen a spoon and was responding to the question. So that's how that whole myth arose, is because the left hemisphere of the brain talks a lot. However, that doesn't really make it more logical.
I love that. I actually became aware of that particular surgery because a number of years ago, a friend of mine who is a meteorologist at National Weather Service had a child who had seizures, and then they ended up having that surgery.
No.
And so she was posting about it on Facebook, and like the classic Renaissance woman, I'm like, what is this? Must dive down this rabbit hole. And I read all sorts of stuff about it. And then the other way that I've kind of become familiar with that and some of the concepts of neuroplasticity and all those types of things is my abiding love for Oliver Sacks. He,
of course,
I will put a number of links into the show notes for this, but he is such a wonderful storyteller, first and foremost, much like you. And he also is the neuroscientist and he has the lived experience. And so the stories that he tells, my favorite book title, I think, is, what is it? The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat Stand or something like that.
It's a hat, but yeah.
For a hat, yes. It's just like face blindness and just like all of these different things that just makes me love neuroscience. If I was not a meteorologist, neuroscience by far is my second favorite of the sciences, because the human brain is so intriguing and yep. How it can change and how it can adjust and all of that is just so cool. What drew you into neuroscience?
Well, funny you should mention Oliver Sacks. He was a huge reason that drew me
in. Oh, nice. I love it. I love it.
I went to college to do natural sciences, which allowed me to diversify as much as possible without choosing a specialty, even though I chose science over music. And I had a boyfriend, I think it was my boyfriend at the time, who gave me one of Oliver Sacks' books. And it was that one. It was The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, or told me about that book. I had already been interested in the brain and how it worked, but that was one of the things that really drew me in, was reading that book. Little did I know at the time that Oliver Sacks was himself a real Renaissance person.
Yeah.
He entered that part of his career, the medical part of his career, late in life, and the writing and storytelling part even later in life. He was also a bodybuilder. He also swam in the open water. He had all of these facets to himself that were not just what he did for a living. I think I probably was drawn to that as much as the stories and the fascination of the brain, even though I wasn't really aware of it. Time.
Yeah.
So yeah, he was a huge reason.
That's great. A lot of the Renaissance people that I've spoken with, in particular, a number of us who come from the science, actually, no, I wouldn't even limit it to the science and science communicators, just of Renaissance people. Quite a few of them have that background in athletics, and not just I played sports as a kid, but staying into it a little bit longer or being more intensively involved in it. What do you think it is? Is it a chicken or egg situation? Is it that because we're Renaissance people, we're drawn to and do well at sports that require perseverance? Is it our training in childhood and learning to have the athlete's mindset that makes us a good Renaissance person? Once we move past the childhood when, you know, they tell you to be well-rounded as a child. So they're like, oh, yes, participate in all the things. But, oh, you're going to college? You got to focus now. Like, settle down. Music was fun. Put that aside, though. Now you got to really be a focused grown-up and get serious. Do you have any thoughts on that athletic mindset and how it fits into our Renaissance person-ness?
Yeah. So there's limited neuroscience in this. More like my own personal feeling.
Yeah.
But I think this makes me think about flow state and what it is to be totally absorbed in something and how there's so much similarity in that state, whether you get into that through, you know, reading deeply and going down that rabbit hole or doing a bunch of data analysis. I imagine what people get if they love coding, although I do not, or playing music with other people, or, you know, going on a long run, or in my case, getting into the ocean and just, you know, putting my head down and swimming, that there's something about the ability to be fully absorbed in a task or an activity or a state of being that is really conducive to tapping into not just deeply into the thing, but also into this sort of sense of like awe and wonder and this feeling of passion about something. And so I think that's something that a lot of people have in common when they excel at something, or if they're a generalist, is that they're able to tap into that state. And that state is kind of conducive to generating new ideas, to having those aha moments, to making those new connections, you know, which is relevant to probably something else we're going to touch on here.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, that might draw us also into those kinds of activities that lead to flow state. So like there's an absorption about playing a team sport. And I used to play a lot of team sports. I used to play water polo and I loved the team aspect of it. But now I'm much more drawn to swimming by myself, or maybe with just a couple of other people in a large body of water, less communication, less conversation, more just flow. And I think either of those can lead you that way. But yeah, there's something there that facilitates that connection making and that creativity.
Do you feel like the concept of flow is one that perhaps in the past really got categorized as like woo-woo, that's like not backed by science? But as we're doing more research and learning more about how the brain works, that we are starting to see some of that scientific support for an idea that might have previously been considered just out there and not real.
Yeah, yeah. So I think in the past, it was either woo-woo or it just wasn't found studyable. So I worked in experimental psychology, which is now kind of blended with neuroscience. So try and get at what's happening in the brain by creating these tests that will test a particular cognitive function. Of course, there's no such thing as a cognitive function, but these are like mental constructs or ideas that we come up with to explain what's going on. So like memory, for example. And so, you know, you could maybe think about coming up with a computer game or something kind of card game or some kind of test that would test somebody's short-term memory or their problem-solving ability. But like, how do you test creativity or flow state? You know, it's harder to do those things. And I feel like there was a little bit of a sort of revolutionary moment in my mind in neuroscience when people started to study what was happening. I mentioned earlier that the brain is always busy, even when we're not doing anything. When people started to study what the brain is doing when we're not doing anything, Marcus Reichel and others came up with this term, resting state, which A, implies that there's a state when we're resting, and B, they were able to identify these networks of brain areas that were reliably co-active while we're at rest. And they named this the resting state network, and it involved, you know, a pretty widespread group of brain areas that's not super important what they are for this conversation, and started to see that those areas are more active when our mind is wandering, when we're daydreaming, when we're planning for the future, and when we're recalling the past. So when we're making connections ourselves and when we're entering those states. And after that, or around that time, brain imaging technology got good enough that we could start to, you know, do things like put somebody in an MRI scanner and instruct them to let their mind wander, or instruct them to do a creative pursuit like improvising music as opposed to playing a rehearsed piece of music, and then to see what's happening in the brain during these times, and to see things, for example, like areas in our frontal lobe that are usually our cognitive controllers that allow us to direct our attention, that allow us to suppress inappropriate actions, that allow us to sort of stick on that path that we have. Those areas actually are less active when we're riffing or sort of creating something new or improvising or entering that sort of mind-wandering state. And there is a creative process that's happening. There is a real thing associated with that kind of flow state. And now there's like study after study, and it's been really cool to see those coming out.
Now, I recently read an article where it was talking about, I believe it was fMRI. So that's the MRI that's actually showing what's happening, not just a single picture, but like functional while it's happening.
Yeah, interestingly, same machine.
Same machine.
Okay. But the F stands for functional in the sense that you're looking over time at brain activity, not just taking a snapshot of the anatomy.
So in the article, it was saying that some big questions need to be asked about the conclusions that are being made from studies that use fMRIs, because they're having people do a task, and maybe it's a short task that doesn't last very long, and they're like, oh, this part of the brain lit up, so that's definite proof that, you know, that part of the brain does this activity. But then they're not able to replicate it, or that part of the brain lights up for all these other activities, and so they can't necessarily say that it actually is tied to that. Is there any big reckoning that's happening right now regarding fMRIs? Or is this just, I happened to come across an article from somebody who just is trying to like stir the pot and make trouble?
No, I don't think that they're making trouble, but I also don't think it's a crisis around fMRI. I mean, I think before fMRI came upon us, before we were able to look at a part of the brain, I'm going to say lighting up because that's how it's represented. After you've done all the analysis, it doesn't light up in real time, by the way. You have to do all this analysis and then you can generate like a red blob in the area that was most active during this task.
And by active, it just means it's giving an electrical signal, basically, like the neuron
is
releasing.
Well, it does, but MRI is not measuring an electric signal. So MRI is measuring a proxy for that electric signal, which is actually to do with the deoxygenation of hemoglobin in the area. Mm. So MRIs can measure one ion. It's usually hydrogen, but it doesn't have to be hydrogen. They can be essentially like programmed to other ions. Hydrogen's great because we have a lot of it around in our bodies because we're mostly made of water, which is H2O. And so it's detecting these little subtle changes in the way that hydrogen molecules behave. I'm no physicist, so I'm going to not go any further than that.
I'm married to an organic chemist, so I'll just go down and ask him a little.
Yeah, you can ask him about how MRI works. And essentially what we're looking for is these little shifts in the deoxygenation of hemoglobin. Now, what does that mean? Our bodies and brains need oxygen to function. So if a body area or a brain part is working hard, it's going to be using oxygen and causing that deoxygenation of hemoglobin to happen, we can see that. And that signal is called the blood level dependent signal or BOLD signal. It's not blood flow. It's not electrical activity, but it's something that goes along with electrical activity more than other things like blood flow or breathing or any other like biological signal. And so we are looking at something real that is indicative of what's happening. So does that mean that MRI is flawed? I mean, yes and no. Like every scientific method, it's just its thing, and then it has to be taken alongside other things. But what you're talking about is another layer that's not really criticizing the method as such. It's criticizing the way it's analyzed. So for a long time before MRI was around, we had these ideas that these different areas of the brain did different things because of studies like the ones that Oliver Sacks describes in his book, which I super highly recommend reading. So the man who mistook his wife for a hat who had face blindness, which coolly Oliver Sacks also had himself to some degree. like writes later about mistaking his own reflection for another person because he didn't recognize himself.
I love that story.
Yeah. So this person was missing a part of their brain. They'd had a stroke or a brain injury. I forget what caused it. And they were actually missing a chunk of their brain. And so people had started to make these associations. Oh, well, this area must be responsible for this. Remember, I told you about the language areas before. So this language area must be responsible for language. We know that because there was a patient named Tan who lost that area in an accident and could only say the word Tan. I mean, I don't think that was his actual name, but he was known as Tan because that was the only thing he could say. Well, that must be the area for language generation. So we came up with this, like, wasn't quite phrenology where they used to read the bumps in the head, and you sometimes see those like busts with like the different humors, like, oh, if you're very creative, you have a big bump here. But it was sort of a little bit like that. It's been criticized sometimes as being the new phrenology. So just like, oh, this area does this and this area does this. Now that's fine, but what it led to was things like people scanning people during election season and showing them a picture of the opposing political candidate and then showing the amygdala lighting up and saying, oh, they must feel disgust at this person because the amygdala does disgust. Well, the amygdala probably doesn't do disgust because it also lights up when people experience threat, fear, other kinds of emotions, in memory tasks, in all sorts of other situations. So I think what's been happening is not a change in whether MRI is effective or not, but in how we need to analyze it and look at it. And maybe we should be thinking of the brain as more of a set of interconnected neurons, areas, you know, whatever we have capacity to think about that are working together, whether that's tied together by like activity happening at the same time, or oscillations running through the brain, or there's lots and lots of research going on to figure out exactly how that happens. But we've expanded our view of the brain now because we know that it's not just a bunch of areas doing their specialty thing. So the brain areas too, I guess, are like Renaissance brain areas in the sense that they are multifunctional, and it depends who they interact with as to what function they're subserving.
Yeah. One of the things that I think Renaissance people are very good at is this idea you're talking about of let's complicate the narrative. When I take a survey and I have to pick A, B, or C, I'm like, oh no, I need like a checkbox where I can pick as many of the below answers as seem appropriate to me. And I feel like to be a neuroscientist nowadays, if that kind of questioning is happening, you have to be open to the narrative getting more and more complex. Yet the ideal of science is to simplify and make these elegant single equation that explains everything. Is that kind of pulling scientists, do you think, in two different directions of I want to think about the world in even more of a complex way, whatever I'm studying, but yet I want to simplify and have that elegance as well?
I'm just thinking about that. I don't really think that scientists do want that single elegant answer. I just think that we haven't been very good at communicating the extent to which science is about nuance and not understanding and complicating things. I'm only going to speak for the science that I know best, which is biological science. So this may actually not be universal to all the sciences because, you know, maybe there's a world in which physicists are looking for the most elegant equation. But I've also talked to a lot of physicists who are also looking for these like really, really complicated things that can only be modeled with vast amounts of computer code, for example. And so I have a feeling it stands for at least some other fields. I think that it's just a little challenging when you're communicating a concept to try and show all of the chaos and the nuance. And also as scientists, I think we've been trained to portray ourselves as objective and that there is some kind of, you know, like truth behind what we're looking for. Even though most scientists, if you ask them, like, is science a search for truth? They would say, well, no, there's no truth. Like, what even is truth? You know,
they go philosophical.
What we're doing is asking questions.
Yeah. Capital T.
Right.
Truth.
All we're doing is asking questions.
Yeah.
And if somebody asks me about a scientific finding, well, is this true? I'll say, well, I don't know. Like, it's true under this set of circumstances for this number of participants, but in this very particular condition. And like, we can probably guess that it might apply to like a larger population or a larger condition. I don't think we're looking for that static one truth. I think for me, science has always been this expansive, let's complicate it. Let's go down this rabbit hole. Oh, this finding doesn't quite make sense. Why is that? Can we go in that direction? But I think that science has set itself up to be an authority in the world, to have to be the thing that says how things are. And that's sort of like gatekeeping of knowledge, if you like, created that fallacy.
Is the fact that they chose to call them laws, like laws of nature, laws of physics, does that almost imply that sort of being in charge, knowing the answer, being the leader?
I mean, maybe. I mean, yeah, like it's true. Like physicists were searching for these like overarching things that could explain everything in the universe, right? But that's never been my personal brand of science. But
yeah,
so yeah, whether they're laws or rules, but you know what they really are theories.
Yeah.
And if you listen to physicists now, they'll talk much more about theories or models. Like models is a little bit of a jargon term in particular, right? I think to most people a model means somebody who walks down a runway with clothes on, or maybe
or not, you know, many clothes on,
something that you make with glue in your childhood bedroom that's like a plane or something. But like a model is also, I don't know the scientific term, it's like a theory, it's a way of explaining stuff. And I think words like model or theory suggest that, like, yeah, it's just a toy, it's just an idea, and it stands for now, but it could change. And I like that. I like that phrasing more, and I think we're more coming into that kind of language now. But do we do ourselves and everybody else wrong by calling these things laws and implying that they're sort of telling everyone how things are? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you've kind of gotten into this a little bit, but in the work that you're doing now, are you doing MRI research or anything like that at the moment?
I'm not doing research anymore. So I formally ended my research in 2018. I did carry on collaborating with a colleague for a couple more years. But at this stage, science communication is my main thing. And I haven't done active research for a few years now.
So in what you're doing now, did you evolve to this point because this felt like it was allowing you to be more of the Renaissance person connecting the dots than previous roles that you've played? Or where did you find that your Renaissance person qualities were most valuable to the work that you were doing in your career?
Yeah, let me think. So as a scientist, before I did all of the things, I was very, very single-mindedly a science researcher. I had a faculty position that I'd worked incredibly hard for, and I worked incredibly long hours at that. I didn't take vacations because of it. I said no to things all the time because of it. I made it my whole identity, and I became, you know, very hyper-focused on my area of expertise, which is researching memory and happens. And so I wasn't really thinking about being a polymath at all. Honestly, I had my hobbies. I was swimming in my spare time, and I was playing music in my spare time, but I thought of them as spare time things. And what really shifted for me was I started to meet these people who were communicating science in different ways. I started off by joining a group called New Right. That was a science writing group that brought together scientists, writers, people in theater, meet people from the media, you know, to collaborate. My goal was just to write better science papers so that I could get published in my like niche journals, but like fancier niche journals that would get me like tenure and promotion and funding. But I was around these people and I liked these people and I was drawn to them. And I found myself learning a lot from them in a way that I didn't learn from my colleagues who were in the same niches as me doing the same things. Thank you very deeply. about MRI and whether this analysis technique works. And they were wonderful too, but this was a different kind of wonderful. And I ended up telling this story for the Story Collider, a nonprofit organization that I am still involved with to this day, which spoils the ending of this story because I actually didn't want to tell this story at all. I didn't really think I had a story to tell. I certainly didn't think I had a story to tell that was special to me in any way. As a scientist, I always knew that I had to have my like unique viewpoint and my little niche and be the only one. And I only had this story about my grandmother who had dementia. And I remember thinking to myself, like, everybody knows somebody with dementia. Like, why would I tell this story? What's special about that? Why would that mean anything to people? And after I grudgingly worked on it, and I'm super grateful to Erin Barker, who is my producer, for sticking with me despite all my complaints and not wanting to do it and reluctance. You know, I told this story on a stage in Brooklyn somewhere. Maybe there were 100 people in the room. Most of them I didn't know. And people came up to me after I told this story and they thanked me so much for sharing my story because they were going through something really similar with a family member, with somebody that they knew. And then I got it. I got that it didn't need to be special or different. What made it relatable to people was that it wasn't special or different, that it was similar to their story, that they weren't by themselves, that they could relate to it, that I put into words something that they were struggling with. And it was so devastating for me in the best possible way. Like all of that affectation that I had, that I just needed to be this like very, very talented, special niche researcher doing my thing in my little vacuum, just fell away. And I realized that I was a human being doing a human endeavor that could help other human beings. And it changed everything for me. It changed the way I mentored. It changed the type of people who approached my lab because they had heard me be a human being. And so I started to get all these people from different backgrounds. I had high school students knocking on the door of my lab. I still don't know how they got in, asking if they could join my lab before I had built my lab because they heard my story on NPR and they wanted to work with somebody who thought like me, related like me, changed the way I taught. It changed the entire direction of everything. And eventually it changed my career. And I think that it wasn't voluntary. You know, I wasn't looking for it. So like sort of when you asked, like, was that something that I was drawn to? Yes, but it wasn't conscious. I just got sucked into it. And I'm very, very lucky that I had met somebody in my like first year or so in New York who sort of almost like flippantly said to me, oh, I just say yes to everything here because this city's so rich. You just never know what you're going to get into. And I kind of internalized that. And I had started saying yes to things that like I didn't want to do, that I wasn't really sure about, as long as I was safe. She was like, as long as it's safe. And if I hadn't said yes to that, it wouldn't have happened for me, really, because I would have just been totally happy on my own path.
Yeah. The last time you and I were together in person was actually to see one of my brother's musical theater improv shows.
Yes.
That was very fun to connect. And Brian has been a guest on the podcast. And one of the things we were talking about, how New York City is a magnet for Renaissance people. Specifically the people who are New York City transplants, because it has this life, it has so many opportunities, so many different things, so many different people, and packed into a very small space. The boroughs are not that big, though. My goodness, it took us forever to drive from Brooklyn to the JFK airport last week. But maybe if we had better mass transit, but we will talk about that on another episode. But New York City does seem to have that. Have you found that a lot of the people in New York City really do give off that Renaissance person vibe that you've been connecting with and move to the city because of the offerings that it has?
I don't think it's that they all give off the same Renaissance person vibe. But I mean, this is a hard city to live in. It's brutal, right? It's expensive. It's fast paced. It smells bad. It's too hot in the summer. It's too cold in the winter. Many of us are very, very far from our families and where we grew up. Like, why would we stay here if there wasn't something for us here? And what's for us here is opportunity. It could be cross-pollination and meeting other people and finding new paths, or it could be the opportunity for excellence and to rise to the top, whether that's being on Broadway or, you know, making it as a musician or working in a world-class university, or like we have all of those opportunities here. You know, I was drawn here to be single-minded and I stayed here to be multifaceted. And so I've seen it from both sides. And I think we have both here. The important thing is that it like connects to what you're dreaming about to some degree. And yeah, you know, it really changed my perspective. I previously lived in Oxford in England. It's a small city. It's pretty homogeneous. The university makes up a big chunk of it. I met a lot of people who were like me. And here I meet a lot of people who are not like me. And that makes me, ironically, more of myself, but like a different version of myself.
So when you meet these many people who are not like you, I'm going to ask the dreaded question. You're now training people how to be storytellers, but it's always hard. We teach what we struggle with. I struggle too. How do you answer the question? So what do you do in a way that feels like it embraces your complexity and doesn't simplify you down too much, but also isn't a 20-minute spiel when they just wanted to say hi and they got to get off the train at the next stop?
I mean, if I had this solved, that would be great. The short answer is I sort of pick and choose a little bit how I want to connect with people. So ideally, I find out something about them first. This is not necessarily storytelling. It's more communication 101.
Know thy audience.
Which is, yeah, figure out who you're talking to. And in a one-on-one situation, you have the ability to do that and then connect with them about something. So that might mean that I end up telling somebody that I'm a musician or that I'm a scientist when that isn't like my main day job thing that I do. But that's one of the joys of being somebody who does many things, right? Is that you have many points of contact and many, many ways to connect with folks. So I don't really have a one-size-fits-all. But if I need to, I say I'm a science communicator. And what does that mean? It means that I help scientists to communicate their work to each other and people outside of their field in all kinds of ways. And that is completely unclear to people. Nobody has any idea what I just said when I say that. And then I have to list all kinds of examples.
Yeah.
As ways that I do that, particularly at Stellate, which is my main job, which is a communications company that I work with. What we do is basically a whole range of things, some of which fall under words that scientists don't like to hear, like PR.
Journalists also don't like PR. When I went to journalism school at the University of Missouri, we referred to the PR folks as the dark side. Our high and mighty journalists who are all objective in all of our telling of news stories. And then right. There's those evil PR people. Ooh.
Right. But what PR actually stands for, right? Just public relations.
Yeah. You know, it's not so bad.
It's just communicating with people. But yeah, it does have a bad name.
Or marketing. That's the other word. Scientists and journalists definitely do not like the term marketing. Networking is also one a lot of people don't like.
I know.
I'm like, well, let's talk about it as like gardening. Let's use metaphors. Like you're saying, like give examples, use metaphors, find a way to connect with something that they already know and understand, and then build off of that. And because we have so many different interests, there's a lot of things for us to pick between to build off of. Do you find that you think about a golden thread in everything going on in your own both career, but also broader interests? Do you see any sort of golden thread for you?
No, I think I'm still looking for the golden threads. I knew who I was for so long through the lens of being a scientist and a researcher. And I had my entire career mapped out. You know, I knew who I was going to be and where I was going to be when I was in my 90s, if I made it that far.
Yep.
And hadn't worked myself into the crowd, which was a real possibility. I knew that I was going to be some kind of emeritus professor roaming the halls of some university, you know, writing a book, amassing my life's work. I knew exactly how I was going to be. And I blew all of that up when I changed careers at the old age of 38 and stepped into a field that I had no formal education in. I have a PhD, but it's in neuroscience. I don't have any formal training in science communication, public engagement with science, which is one of my other real passions, is not just communicating, but engaging in a bi-directional way with publics about science. I don't have any formal training in that. I learned it all on the job. It's like very kind of like feels very uncertain. And when I changed into this field, I asked my first boss, what's your 5-year plan?
And they laughed.
Well, how do you know what you're going to do? And she laughed.
Yeah.
And she said, well, I don't have one. And I was like melting down in this cafe that we were having lunch in. like feeling my whole pathway unravel in front of me. And I said, well, how do you make decisions around your career and your life then? And she said, I just connect to my values. And so I think that's the golden thread. Maybe if there is a golden thread, is that I'm so grateful for that guidance. And I sit down on a regular basis now and I do sort of semi-painful exercise where I try and figure out, well, what are my values and what are the top three values that I have? And then I look back and how do they compare to the ones I had 6 months ago or 3 years ago? But more importantly, I look forward and I say, well, how is what I'm doing serving those? And it helps me make decisions all the time about what I'm going to be doing next, and what I'm going to say yes to, and where I'm going to head myself. So yeah, I guess my values and what I'm passionate about are now the golden thread. But I don't literally now don't know where that's going to lead me. And I don't know what I'm going to look like or what I'm going to be doing when I'm 90. And that's part of the joy of it, the very uncomfortable joy.
Yeah. And I think actually it sets you up a little bit better to be working from that mindset, because when the pandemic hit, for example, if you'd been in the lab and had all these people scheduled to come in for their MRIs and then the lab had been shut down, like that would have completely ruined those plans or thrown them out or required things to change, versus now you're kind of loading on the river and following the current, as opposed to I'm just going to force this. I'm going north. No matter what, I'm going north. You now are kind of like letting the flow of the river, to go back to flow, kind of guide you. And then you're adjusting. And if you get in an eddy, you're going to do a little spinning around for a bit and then you'll keep going. For me, it seemed like we always grew up thinking that like a career and a steady job and knowing what singular I'm going to be when I grow up is going to give me more certainty. But actually being in this freedom to follow the things, the opportunities that arise, the serendipity that comes forth is almost more reliable, because you have yourself. You'll always have yourself. You'll always have your values. That can't be taken away from you just because you lose a job or you can't access an MRI machine. You have stability by being flexible as opposed to having that rigidity to your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And it builds this kind of resilience. It's really beautiful, right? We learn this as swimmers. You know, you can't fight a current. You can swim against it for 8 hours.
Exhaust yourself.
And you'll be extremely tired and you won't have made any progress.
Yeah.
You know, or you can work with it, particularly when you're swimming in waves and chop and wind. And, you know, you can't swim in waves if you fight the waves. You'll probably drown. You can only swim in waves if you roll with the waves and let them take you to some degree and play with them. And, you know, I love swimming in chop. And I think that's kind of how my life is now. I love swimming in chop.
Wonderful. Well, I think we'll transition, because let's roll with the punches and let's play a little game. You have heard the game before because you've listened to past episodes, and it is the fill in the blank. You know you're a Renaissance person if. And the challenge that I always give myself is that I do not let myself write down my answer ahead of time, because that isn't fair. I try to do it as a riff off of what you're talking about when we have our conversation together. So I will go first and then you can go second. So my first one of, you know you're a Renaissance person if, will be, you know you're a Renaissance person if your childhood photo book or Facebook posts are full of you in all sorts of different costumes. One might be you on the stage in a play. Another one might be you in a football outfit. And then the next one is you climbing a mountain and being on math team. It's just you wearing all these different costumes because you were doing so many different things. How about you?
Love that. Love that. Now I'm thinking back. Is that true for me? Yeah, probably. I'm going to say, you know, you're a Renaissance person if you never have quite enough time to do everything you want to do.
Yes. Why can't we expand the day? Come on. Physics, write the equation.
Yeah.
Well, actually, we do know. If we get close enough to the speed of light, we can do time dilation. So there's physics for it. We just
we can work
speed
on
ourselves
that
up
sure.
a little bit.
But, you know, I talk to perfectly fantastic, wonderful, amazing people all the time who are like, you know, when I'm done with my work, I go home and I spend time with my family. And I'm like, great. how do you do that? And the answer is they do that because they don't do other things. And so I feel like it's a mixed blessing, right? Not having enough time because on the one hand, there are so many things I want to do and I'm excited about doing and I'm always committing to these amazing things. And then I'm always feeling a little bit guilty that I didn't spend more time on something or with somebody. So it's like a double-edged sword, I guess.
I have the young children right now who need a lot of time and a lot of attention. And yes, there are times where I'm just like, you know what I could be doing right now? I could be going to a show or I could be running outside in the weather. And nope, I got to focus and spend my time with you. So I understand that. Okay. Do you want to do another one? Do you have another one in mind? Or you can improvise it?
No.
Good.
No,
okay. We're improvising it. Okay. You know you're a Renaissance person if you fly on an airplane, don't have the internet, and fill some sort of note-taking device with all these ideas that you get because you've finally been able to disconnect from the world. That's what happened to me on the most recent flight. I open an email to myself and then I'll type it all in as a draft and then I just kind of leave it in there. And then I'm going to clean that up. I'm going to do a spring cleaning brain dump activity that I will announce to everyone to sign up for. But yeah, getting away from... So Artemis II's mission was yesterday where they were taking pictures on the dark side of the moon.
Oh, yes.
And they had about 40 minutes where they had no contact. There was no way that they could contact anyone on Earth because we can't send the signals through the moon. The moon is blocking the signals and the signals can't travel through a physical body like the moon. And I was kind of jealous. I'm like, 40 whole minutes with no ability to connect with anyone on Earth? What relief, what freedom. But they were very busy doing science and taking pictures, which is fun.
Yeah, they kept themselves busy. They had things to do as well.
Yes.
Okay, that's very cool. I love that. Yeah, reminds me to carve out more time like that so that I can have those ideas. Oh no, I signed up. I said yes to this without having any idea what the second thing I would say would be. I mean, this is sort of related to the costume one, but I think you know if you're a Renaissance person, if you have these things around you that represent very different areas. So like I'm just looking around me in my living space right now and I have some artwork on my wall that I painted, like this picture behind me. I have artwork that represents the brain. I have an amp behind me for playing the flute. I have a microphone in front of me for podcasting. I have all these different accoutrements. I have books on all kinds of things. I have a yoga mat. I have, you know, so I feel like if you're a Renaissance person, if you, not necessarily as crowded as my space, I think you could be a minimalist Renaissance person.
It's eclectic.
Yeah, if you have items around you that are of an eclectic nature.
That is perfect and so very true of what I see around when I look around in the living room right now. Okay, well, let's jump to the rapid-ish fire questions because, you know, rapid-ish is how we Renaissance people roll. So what is one metaphor that you find yourself using frequently?
I think we already used it. I think it's the flow state metaphor. I think about the water a lot for my metaphors, and that comes up again and again.
So I'm not super familiar with my English geography. How close is Oxford to like a large body of water, be it the ocean, or did you grow up with water? Were you out on the water a lot growing up?
I did not. So I grew up in a town in Manchester in the northwest of England, and then I lived in Oxford for a long time. Neither is terribly far from the water, but neither is right on the banks of anything. There was a lake in Oxford. My friends had a sailing boat. I would sometimes go sailing with them. But actually all my swimming when I was younger, except when I went on holiday to the coast in Wales, was in a pool.
Okay.
So I spent inordinate amounts of time. If you scratch and sniff me, I smell like chlorine. And... Yeah, so it wasn't the open water for a long time for me. It was the pool. It was a lot of structure. It was a lot of laps. I did synchronized swimming for years, which is a little known fact about me. And it wasn't until I moved to New York, where I was literally surrounded by water on all sides, that I met these open water people.
That is intriguing. I'm sure there's so much more that could be said about that, but we're going to move on. What's one rabbit hole that you've gone down recently?
I've been going down a rabbit hole about AI, which probably doesn't make me very special. In particular, I've been thinking about whether it's harmful or helpful. I have a lot of anxieties about the environmental impact of AI as well, which means I haven't been using it very much, because especially like generative AI, because I feel like there's a huge environmental impact of it.
Absolutely.
But also, I do think it's important to be informed. That's clearly where the world's going. I have clients who use AI or are in the AI world.
Yeah.
I think it's really important for me to be informed and understand it. And so one of the rabbit holes I've been going down is about individuals using AI and whether or not that can be harmful, in addition to the obvious benefits that there can be for it, and found out some pretty alarming, weird, strange things about the way that AI, especially these like generative AI chatbots, are programmed.
Yes.
That to me as a psychology neuroscience type of person is really fascinating, but also kind of horrifying, the way that they, you know, talk to people, encourage things that they shouldn't be encouraging.
Yep.
You know, might also be helping people deal with things like loneliness, but also potentially taking advantage of that is a weird way to put it, because hoping that they're not cognizant.
Yeah. We don't want to anthropomorphize them too much.
We don't. But certainly are programmed in such a way that when people are experiencing things like loneliness, or, you know, being at a crossroads or trying to pursue something that maybe isn't working out for them, that they can be coaxed into directions that are really, really harmful for them. And then thinking about what can we do about that as communicators? What can I do about things like that as a science communicator?
I think I've seen a change. So I currently teach the University of Arizona undergrad and grad students in a class. We meet virtually, and then I see them in person when I fly into town. But I have seen a difference in the way that particularly my students write since we started 5 years ago. And one of the biggest things that's just shocked me is we have them apply by filling out a very simple survey. And like one of the questions is, why do you want to be part of this project? And I can tell you every single student who used AI to write their answer. And I'm like, you can't answer for yourself. Why do I want to be part of this? You're not getting graded. We're not going to be like, oh, invalid. I'm not going to pick you to be on this team if you like tell us, but they have to use the AI. I'm like, okay, do we not, have we lost the ability to like think critically and articulate how we feel? Like, can we talk about our own feelings without having a computer do it for us? And that seems like a big loss if we can't.
Yeah, I think we're certainly losing confidence, right? Yeah. That instinct to be like, well, what do I think?
Yeah.
Is it acceptable? I do think that there's a real pressure now to call on those tools for even things that like, yeah, obviously nothing can tell you what you think about something.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's this sort of pressure to, it's a different kind of pressure to conform than maybe the pressures that were present when we were at that age.
Yeah.
But still, it's still there, right?
Yeah. Very intriguing. Okay. One last question, which is, you've already told us about the synchronized swimming, but what's something from your background that might surprise people? And you can take the definition of the word background very widely.
I can't believe you took the synchronized swimming from me.
Hey, you shared it yourself. That was not my fault.
That's true. I can't believe I took it from myself.
You fell for it.
That is usually the one that I use.
And if you need a suggestion, I have one based on a video I recently saw of yours.
Oh, okay. Well, let's come back to that. See if it, I mean, the thing that I think is most surprising to people, but also does kind of make sense, is that I was really shy as a kid, that I am an introverted person deep in my heart, and that I don't know how I ended up here, basically, where I talk for a living.
And I enjoy it. And you're great at it.
I would describe myself now as an ambivert. You know, I'm not an extroverted introvert. Yeah, I'm on a stage all the time. I was on a stage as a kid as well. I played music on a stage. I had some confidence, but I also didn't have the confidence to talk to anybody or represent myself in that way. And so I do think that that part of me still exists. And one of the things it does, of course, is it gives me a lot of empathy for people who are in that situation. And also gives me a lot of appreciation for where I'm at now. But I'm curious as to what you were going to suggest.
So my suggestion was that you trained your cat to pee in a toilet.
I did. Both of them. Two cats. I think I talked in a 90-second show last week, which, by the way, was a comedy show, and I would not have said I was a comedian, but now I have to.
You have to add that to your growing list.
I talked about one cat, but actually I have two, and I taught them both to use a toilet, and it is still my greatest achievement of all time.
There you go. As I was watching that video, I got not choked up, though I may get choked up as I tell you the story right now. So this is the first podcast episode I'm recording since my dog passed away. She had to be euthanized while we were on our trip to Arizona. So that was very sad. And I've posted about that and how walking her has been when I would get in my flow state and got inspired to do a lot of stuff, including Cued for Thought, my curated podcast playlist. But one of the things I trained her to do, inspired by a friend's dogs, is we have a little, it almost looks like Christmas bells hanging on what looks like a leash on our back door. And we trained her to ring the bell when she needed to go outside to pee.
Oh my God.
And so it's not peeing in a toilet, which would have been kind of funny, but she would ring the bell when she wanted to go outside and use the bathroom. And then she realized, hey, they pay attention to me when I ring the bell. So then she just used it as a like, humans, pay attention to me. You're not paying enough attention to me. I will ring the bell. And I'm like,
she trained you.
This is Pavlov's dog, and I'm Pavlov's dog. And she rings the bell and I respond. So
that's instrumental conditioning.
Yeah. So I got rid of a lot of choice things just so that I didn't walk around the house and like start crying every time I saw something. But I left the bells hanging on the back door as like a little bit of a memory of Choya and how she trained us just as much as we trained her.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Well, I would love to share more of your great stuff because Paula is very prolific in sharing videos and things on social media. So what's the best way if people want to hear your story of training your cats to pee in a toilet and many other things? What's the best way for them to learn and follow you, Paula?
So I'm on some social media. The main platforms I use are Instagram, where I'm at Paula Croxon, and you can see all the weird theater, music, comedy, swimming, collaborations, and the full range of my polymathness comes up there. Also share a lot about my science communication work and what I'm up to in the world of SciComm on LinkedIn, where you can find me, Paula Croxon, on LinkedIn. I also share a lot of opportunities there. So if you're in that field or thinking of going into that field, that's a great place to find me. I also have a website, paulacroxon.com, that it's probably out of date, but I do try and update it every now and again. And yeah, if you're in New York City or remote, you could come to a Story Collider show, check out our podcast. I'm involved at all levels in the storytelling world there. And you could also find out info about me at Stellate Communications, stellatecomms.com, which is where I spend most of my time helping scientists communicate their stuff.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much again. And I'll let you know the next time I'm down in NYC and hopefully we can connect in person again.
Fabulous. So great talking to you, Sarah. Thank you.
So good talking to you.
Connecting the dots with the Renaissance people.